Blog Talk Radio.
Everyone, and welcome to Wild Horse and Burro Radio, an educational outreach program of Wild Horse Freedom Federation. You're welcome to call in with any questions you may have for our guests during the second half hour of the show. Before I introduce our guest, I want to make a quick announcement to remind all of you that there's language in the 2018 budget that would allow almost 50,000 wild horses and burros in BLM holding facilities and tens of thousands more on our public lands to be euthanized. Please be sure to call your U.S. senators and let them know that you do not want our wild horses and burros to be killed, euthanized, or sterilized, and that you do not want horse slaughterhouses to be allowed in the United States. Our guest tonight is George Werthner. George is the executive director of Public Lands Media, a project of the Earth Island Institute. He's the vice president on the board of directors for Western Watersheds Project and the author of 38 books. George was the Ecological Projects Director and Senior Scientist for the Foundation for Deep Ecology and Tompkins Conservation for 12 years. Prior to this, George taught ecology courses at a number of universities, worked as a botanist, backcountry ranger, river ranger, biologist, and forestry technicians for various federal agencies, including the Bureau of Land Management, the National Park Service, and the Forest Service. George has also been a wilderness guide in Alaska and Yellowstone National Park. Welcome to the show, George. Hello?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now, George.
Okay.
George, to start, can you please give us a quick overview of livestock grazing on public lands?
Yes, I'd be happy to do that. The livestock on public lands is the single biggest commercial use of our public lands, affecting, if you count state lands as part of that public lands amount, over 300 million acres. And to give you an idea of how large that is, California is a little over 100 million acres. So we're talking about an area that's as big as three Californias. And so a very significant amount of land. And most of that land lies between the Continental Divide and the Rockies and the Sierra Cascades on the West Coast. And that part of the country is about the most arid part of the whole United States. That's, you know, states like Nevada, Utah, Arizona, and so forth, southern Idaho. And these areas are not particularly adapted to the impact from livestock production. And I say the term production because it includes more than just grazing a plant. Production would include things like that happens to facilitate livestock, like predator control, the removal of water from rivers to make hay production, and so forth. So livestock production is a huge impact. But particularly on the public lands, because as a rule, what is left as public lands has been the lands that are more fragile, more arid than what passed into private ownership.
Can you tell us about the impacts of livestock grazing on water?
Oh, there are many, many impacts on.
Before you start answering that, George, I'm getting a lot of background noises like dishes rattling and people coughing. I don't know what's going on, but I'm getting a lot of background noise. I don't know where it is.
Well, it's not here. I'm by myself in a room.
Well, me too. Me too. And Marty said everything else is muted but us. So us. Why don't I, George, go ahead and tell people about, well, now I'm not hearing it, so maybe it went away. Okay, so just give us an overview of the impacts of livestock grazing on water.
Sure. Well, there are many ways that livestock production particularly affects water. The most obvious is that cattle and sheep tend to congregate near water supplies, like creeks and lakes and so forth. And then when they defecate, a lot of that manure, et cetera, winds up in our water supplies. And what studies have shown is that E. coli, which is a bacteria that's harmful to humans, generally exceeds safe standards in any areas where there's significant number of livestock grazing occurring. So you have the water pollution problem. You also have the fact that livestock tend to break down of waterways, and that increases erosion, so you get more sedimentation in streams. And that's a big problem for example, fish that need clean beds, gravel beds for spawning. So you get a lot of sedimentation in a stream, and that negatively impacts trout, salmon, and other native fishes. A third impact of livestock on water is just simply how much water they drink. I mean, if you've got a lot of cattle out there, they're going to drink a lot of water, particularly in smaller streams and springs, to the point where the flow is diminished, and anything that's relying on that water besides cattle, wildlife, you know, anything from frogs on up through the, you know, to bigger animals, has that much less water to consume. And then there's the use of water from our rivers and streams and groundwater increasingly for the production of hay. Now this occurs usually off of federal lands, but it's still an impact in the sense that water is diverted or sucked out of streams and used to grow hay and alfalfa, and it's typically the biggest use of water in all the western states. And so when rivers run dry or shrink because the water is being taken out of it to grow hay, well, that takes away from the habitat of fish and other aquatic wildlife and insects. And then that has repercussions up and down the food chain. So if you have less fish, you have less food for bald eagles or mink or otter. And so it has a significant impact that way. And it also means that this, because less water warms up more, it tends to change the temperature of the water, which can also be detrimental to stuff like trout, which require cold water. So those are just a few of the ways that livestock production negatively impacts water. And it's an amazing statistic to look at how much water is used by livestock. For example, in California, which most people realize, you know, has more urban areas, you know, golf courses and swimming pools and everything else than any other western state. But even in California, only about 15% of the water consumed is by urban areas, and the vast majority of water is used for agriculture. And of that percentage used for agriculture, some of it's growing lettuce that we might in the middle of winter or whatever, but the vast majority of it is for growing forage for livestock. So it's a very significant impact, particularly in the fact that most of the areas that we're talking about are arid to begin with. So taking a significant amount of that water to grow forage for livestock, or allowing it to be polluted and harmed by livestock, has all sorts of repercussions for all sorts of other animals and plants.
Yeah. So even if hay is or forage for the livestock is being grown on private land, it's still using water that's the public's water or
that's
everybody's
exactly,
water. So it's
And it's an important, you just reminded me of a very important point to make, and that is that all the water in the western states, there's different rules apply back east, but in western United States, all the water is technically owned by the public in each state. So mm-hmm. when you hear the term water right, which is thrown around a lot, what a water right is the right to that determines who gets to use the water and in what amounts if, and this is the big point, if the public decides that it wants to allow the water to be used for that purpose. Now, for the most part, irrigation and dewatering of streams for livestock production haven't been challenged by anybody, except in very rare cases. But there is this whole thing called the public trust doctrine, which suggests that the states, state governments, have an obligation to manage things like water for the public good. And of course, increasingly, given the urbanization of the West and the greater reliance on water for other purposes, it's getting harder and harder to justify having most of the water in the West go for livestock production when it's especially detrimental to a whole lot of other users.
Well, and that, just when you talk about water right, it's basically a privilege. And just like grazing rights, you know, the ranchers often treat public lands as if they're their own personal property. I think it's a right and not a privilege. So I know we'll get into that more a little later in the show maybe, but, you know.
It's the same thing, that, like it's a right.
It's worth, exactly, and it's worth repeating it over and over again. Of course, the language you use to describe these things affects how people perceive things, and it's not an accident that ranchers talk about things like water rights and grazing rights. Because they want to imply that they have some sort of ownership and proprietary use of these lands and water, when in fact, in every case, we're talking about something that is granted to the individuals by the public. And what we grant, we can take back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Could you please describe to our newer listeners what riparian areas are? And then tell us about the four C's.
Sure. Riparian areas are typically referred to as the thin green lines along waterways. Now, that could be rivers, that could be streams, creeks, springs, lakes, etc. But the area influenced by water, and particularly in drier, more arid landscapes, we have a very narrow strip of green vegetation that relies on water, and then you get into, you know, beyond that strip, you get into plants that are adapted to arid conditions without a lot of water. So, for example, in a state like Nevada, you may have willows and grass and cottonwood trees growing along the river, the riparian area, and then the uplands would be grass and sagebrush, for example, which is, can live without having immediate access to water all the time. So those riparian areas make up a fraction of the landscape, particularly in the more arid areas, and yet a vast majority of wildlife depend on those riparian areas for water, for food, for a place to live. And it's also the same kind of area that attracts the livestock, particularly cattle, which evolved in moist forest lands of Eurasia and sort of just naturally congregate in places that sort of, you might say, remind them of their evolutionary roots of more dense vegetation more lush vegetation and access to water. So, even if you have, I'll just make something up, 100,000-acre grazing allotment, you might only have in that 100,000 acres, 1,000 acres that's riparian, and the cattle will tend to congregate on that 1,000 acres and hardly use a lot of the uplands of the rest of the allotment. So and the reason that's important, has disproportionate impact on all the other wildlife, and it's also the way livestock is managed on public lands. There's a tendency among agencies to say, if we have a 100,000-acre allotment, we're going to disperse the cattle over that whole area, and yet they don't sort of acknowledge that most of the use will be in the riparian areas, even though there's a much larger area accessible.
That's an important point. That's an important point for everyone to know. So then, what are the four C's?
Well, cold water, connected habitat, clean water, and complex habitat. And that particularly refers to in the western United States, where trout are native to a whole lot of, and salmon too, all of the waterways. Cold water is, of course, what they want and need. And they connected habitat refers to the idea that they'd be able to move up and down a stream. And what happens a lot of times, and this gets back to the dewatering situation I mentioned earlier, if you take the majority of the water out of a stream, you disconnect the habitat so the fish are isolated, maybe just in the headwaters of a small stream and can't move up and down the waterway. And clean water, of course, refers to, just as I mentioned earlier, lack of sediment and manure and so forth. And that's very important to prevent things like algae from growing and excess of fertilization of water, since most of the plants, particularly the wildlife and fish species in the West, are adapted to the clean water rather than water that's heavily laden with a lot of nutrients. And then finally, complex habitat refers to the fact that you know, in good, healthy riparian areas, you have everything from shrubs to tall trees to grass and so forth, whereas in riparian areas that have been damaged and impoverished by livestock, they get much more simplified plant communities, if there's even plant communities left, which in most cases you wouldn't have any. But even if you do, they're more simple and have less different kinds of vegetation there, which means, of course, less habitat for plants and animals to exist in.
Well, there are many impacts of livestock grazing on riparian areas. Even, you know, I think I read one of your articles that streams widen and become shallower, and that even has a big effect.
That's in fact. One of the problems with this whole issue is so many riparian areas have been impacted by livestock grazing for so long, most of us don't know what a healthy riparian area looks like. The analogy I sometimes make up is if most people all have, you know, one leg and were hopping around on one leg, you might not recognize somebody who had two legs as being, you know, normal. And that's what we've done to streams around the West. So they are, as you mentioned, tend to be shallower, which means that they heat up more, and they are anything that's residing in that stream, like a fish, is more vulnerable to predators. And the other part of having it shallower is it also means that it has a more likely to be affected by any kind of pollution that might come into it too, because the water is, you know, just like any pollution, if you disperse it over more water, it's going to dilute it. So that's another problem.
If it's a certain type of fish or different types of fish or?
Well, I didn't hear the first part of your question. Sorry. Could you repeat?
Trampling, you know,
yes.
Cattle trample the area?
Well, trampling has, yeah, that's like I said, it breaks down the stream banks and it, you know, adding sediment to the stream. And then also, in some cases, cattle, and especially on smaller streams, can trample the beds, the reeds of spawning beds of fish and affect the eggs that haven't hatched yet. And do some damage that way too. So, you know, it's just something that overall has a lot of impacts in multiple ways.
Yeah, George, I just remembered one thing I wanted to ask you too. Have you ever heard of that global land mitigation study highlighting the land desertification and environmental damage from overgrazing of cattle and sheep?
You know, I don't know if I've heard of the same thing that you have, but over the years there have been a number of papers and even books talking about desertification as a result of livestock grazing. So there are a couple of ways, like I mentioned, trampling of springs and seeps, for example, can reduce their flow. So that adds to sort of desertification, but also soil compaction because of cattle hooves. You know, cattle weigh a lot, or sheep even. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of sheep. they'll compact the soil, which means that water coming from rain or whatever doesn't seep in as well. So that adds to the desertification. And then the third way that it adds to desertification is that when you remove a lot of the vegetative cover, you expose the soil to more evaporation and heating. So I remember one study I read about, and I'm just going to, you know, don't quote me on this as far as the actual numbers, but if I remember correctly, they compared to a grazed area on the Mexican side of the border and an ungrazed area on Oregon Pipe National Monument, which is a national park unit on the Mexican border, which doesn't have grazing. And they found that the, you know, the air temperature, you know, foot or two above the ground was like 20 degrees warmer on the Mexican side, because the American side, where there was no grazing, was doing a better job of reflecting the heat, basically, whereas the Mexican side without the vegetation was absorbing the heat and then re-radiating heat back, and of course, leading to more drying out of the soil. So that's just one of the examples of how desertification works. And then the other part of desertification is when the vegetation is removed, there's less protection for soil from wind as well as water, and you know, you get things like sand dunes growing and so forth. But that's in our picture in our mind. It doesn't have to be sand dunes, but the idea is that without the vegetative cover, we tend to have more desert-like conditions.
With livestock grazing, it also spreads cheatgrass, right? Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yes. Now, cheatgrass is an annual grass from Asia that has gotten into the American West probably about 100 years ago and has gradually expanded across the West. And it's facilitated by livestock grazing in several ways. One is the Western landscape tends to be dominated by what are called bunch grasses. And bunch grasses, as the name suggests, grow in bunches. And in between, there's usually not a lot growing, except on the soil surface are these things called biocrusts. And the biocrusts are made up of algae and lichens and mosses, and they hold the soil together in between the grasses. And as you can imagine, if you have a heavy animal like cows wandering around out there, or a flock of sheep that's tightly kept together, you will break up a lot of that crust. And that facilitates the cheatgrass seeds to get into the ground and germinate if they have the right condition. And the reason that's problematic, there's a number of reasons. One, anytime you get an alien plant in, established, there are all sorts of insects and wildlife that don't feed on it. So you're taking, if it replaces native plants, you take away from the food from all sorts of animals. But the other thing, and this is the big issue today, is that cheatgrass dries out. It greens up earlier, but it dries out earlier than the native grasses, and it therefore becomes very flammable. And a lot of the wildfires that are spreading across rangelands are burning through cheatgrass. And cheatgrass, again, is an annual, which means that the area can burn over and the seeds are often hidden in the soil and not negatively impacted by the fire. So you get more and more cheatgrass every year because it comes back very quickly, whereas the native plants take longer to establish and to mature. So they're at a disadvantage if there's a lot of cheatgrass and wildfires happening at the same time. Now, I hasten to add that, range land ecosystems always had some fire, but not at the frequency that we're seeing today in many areas. And that increased frequency is typically due to cheatgrass. So, for example, with the sage grouse, which is a controversial species right now because it's being proposed for a listing or has been proposed for a listing under the Endangered Species Act, and it's the listing has been precluded for the time being because the federal government decided to allow conservation measures to be implemented to see if that could halt the decline towards extinction. And so all sorts of things are listed as impacting sage grouse. And one of the things they always list is wildfires from cheatgrass, but they never make the connection to livestock. In other words, why do we get cheatgrass? It doesn't just come out of space or something. It's there livestock create the conditions for its spread. And then, by the way, you know, they can carry the cheatgrass seeds in their hair and so forth and put get it into places that might not otherwise have cheatgrass getting established because it's, you know, carried there by the animals themselves.
Livestock grazing impacts all wildlife, and we're going to get into some, you know, several different species that it's particularly impacted. But can you tell our listeners about disease transmission from domestic animals to wildlife?
Yeah, a real classic example of that is bighorn sheep, which are or wild bighorn sheep, used to be very abundant across the western United States. And they have had a huge decline. I think some estimates say there's only like 10% now of the population that used to be found around the West. And a lot of that decline has been due to disease transmission from domestic sheep. It's sort of like what happened to Native Americans when smallpox was spread around the West. The Indian people didn't have quite the resistance to smallpox, not that it didn't hurt white people somewhat too, but most white people could recover from it, whereas the Native Americans suffered much higher mortality. And it's the same thing with sort of the situation between domestic sheep. Diseases that don't kill domestic sheep are deadly for wild bighorns. And part of that also is that the wild bighorns are trying to survive without any additional food supply to them or whatever. So that particularly in the wintertime when they're stressed trying to get enough food, they're more vulnerable to any kind of disease that they may contract from domestic animals. Another disease that I've seen transmitted from domestic sheep to wild bighorns is a thing called pink eye. And pink eye causes the animal to go blind, and it's a pretty gruesome way to go. I've watched walk right off of cliffs, you know, stumble into streams, stand out in the middle of the road completely unaware that a car is coming at them because they can't see them and they're blind. So pink eye is another disease that they can get from domestic animals. And a third one I'd like to mention, if I have time.
Go ahead.
Okay. And it's kind of a different situation, but a long time ago, wild bison around the West, but particularly it's become an issue in Yellowstone Park, got a disease called brucellosis from domestic livestock. And brucellosis in domestic livestock, like cattle, causes the cow to abort its first fetus. And it's the first year that it becomes pregnant, it will abort its fetus. And, of course, this is a real economic impact to ranchers if their herd gets brucellosis because they're losing a lot of calves. And then the other part of brucellosis, it used to cause and I'll explain why in a minute, it used to cause a disease called unguent fever in humans. Now, unguent fever still exists, but very few humans get it anymore. In the old days, that is, I'm talking about like the 1920s and 30s, a significant amount of unguent fever was transmitted in milk that wasn't pasteurized. And with the pasteurization of milk, which became widespread after World War II, the incidence of unguent fever occurring in humans went way, 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 way down. But the health issue was used back in the 1940s to justify a national campaign to rid cattle of brucellosis. And that campaign meant that any cattle that was found to have brucellosis was to be killed, and the herd kept in, can't remember the right word, but kept in confinement until it could be proven that it didn't have brucellosis. So, obviously a lot of ranchers didn't want to see that happen. Well, it turns out that there were dairy cows in Yellowstone back in the 1910s, 20s, and so forth to provide milk because in those days they couldn't transport milk a long time for people working there for tourists. And the bison herd there was infected with brucellosis. Now, the interesting thing is brucellosis doesn't seem to affect bison to the same degree that it does cattle. In other words, they seem it doesn't seem to cause an abortion or very infrequently in bison for some reason. And but in any event, what has it's turned into a big controversy because the USDA, with a huge amount of public money, has gotten brucellosis pretty much limited in the lower 48 states, so that the incidence in domestic herds is very infrequent, and so there's a they don't want to see it transmitted into domestic livestock, and bison coming out of Yellowstone Park in the winter seeking forage because of deep snows mm-hmm. in the park. Are killed every year. I think 1,500 were killed last winter, for example.
Wow.
And the slaughter is justified on the basis of protecting livestock from brucellosis, which, of course, the bison originally got from livestock in the first place. There's a lot, if I may, I want to tell you a little bit more about why that's just a Trojan horse. As I said, the only way that domestic cattle can contract the disease from bison is if they happen to have contact with an aborted fetus, which, as I mentioned, is almost never happens with bison for some reason. So you'd have to have a bison cow abort the fetus, and then you'd have to have cows in the area come and lick the fetus or somehow otherwise come in contact with the fluids. And mm-hmm. that has to happen before the bacteria, the brucellosis bacteria, dies. And it's once it's out in the open, it doesn't live very long. And it has to happen before some other animal doesn't get there and eat the aborted fetus, for example, a coyote or raven or whatever. And so the likelihood of transmission is exceedingly small. Plus, you can inoculate your domestic cattle against brucellosis in it. So although it's not 100% effective, if you keep cattle away from bison and you have your cattle inoculated for brucellosis, the chances of transmission are extremely small. Nevertheless, and the bison are shot when they come out of the park or captured and shipped off for slaughter. And what's mm-hmm. even more showing that it's a Trojan horse is they kill and ship off bison calves and bison bulls, neither of which can transmit the disease to domestic livestock. In other words,
wow.
if I
didn't know that.
Concern was just brucellosis transmission, you would have no reason to be killing bison bulls or calves. Mm-hmm. And then the other part of it that shows that it's a Trojan horse is that to the degree that any cattle have gotten infected in the Yellowstone ecosystem, it's always come from elk, because not only do bison carry brucellosis, but elk and other wildlife do too. And the all the incidences of transmission have occurred with elk. But we don't shoot all the elk as they come out of Yellowstone Park, mostly
mm-hmm,
because
mm-hmm.
Hunters would be outraged if we were killing, hundreds and thousands of
wow.
elk. So
anyhow, this is basically... To appease the livestock industry,
that's
the killing of the bison.
And what it really is, I think, and this gets back to public lands grazing, is that the livestock industry really just doesn't want bison out on public lands outside of Yellowstone Park, because there would be competition then. Bison eat pretty much the same thing as cattle. There
mm-hmm.
would be competition between bison and cattle on these public land allotments. And I think the cattle industry is afraid that if I asked you, would you rather have a bison on that land or have somebody's private livestock on that land, which would you choose? I think a lot of Americans would say, well, I want bison out there. And I think the ranchers
mm-hmm.
know that.
We're running into the exact same thing with the wild horses and burros,
exactly.
The livestock industry
yeah.
is pushing for this killing of all, not only all the ones in holding, but also on our tens of thousands more in public lands. They're just wiping them out. They just don't want it to become competition.
It's exactly that. And so and you know, and I think their fears are justified. In other words, I do think that if there were bison allowed to infiltrate and establish themselves on other public lands surrounding Yellowstone, or as I would like to see them also reestablish on other public lands where there's suitable habitat, in other words, transplanted, in both cases, the livestock industry would see that as a real threat to their continued existence, at least on those particular mm-hmm. lands. And so
on public lands.
They don't want that genie out of the bottle. So
yeah.
They're trying to keep it
They don't want to share at all. Yeah.
Right.
Can you tell, and also, you know, related to this, can you tell us about livestock grazing's impact on wolves?
Well, yeah. Now, that's another, it's a very similar thing in a way. On these grazing allotments scattered around the West, and like I said, there are hundreds of millions of acres in grazing allotments, where the usual methodology of animal husbandry is to take your cattle out there, you know, in, say, June, release them and come back in October and find out how many are left alive. So the first thing is, in a lot of cases, there's very limited supervision of the cattle. And then the second thing is, if you recall, I mentioned aridity has costs. One is the riparian damage, but the other cost is that any livestock out there has to forage wildly in order to get enough to eat. So, you know, particularly in the more dry places like Nevada or, you know, southern Idaho or other places like that, the cattle have to be widely spread to get enough to eat. And as a result, they're more vulnerable to any predator, you know, not just wolves. As a result, ranchers have gotten used to the idea, you know, back in the 1900s and before, they had a concerted effort to rid the West of predators, particularly wolves, but also grizzly bears and cougar, too. And they were pretty successful with at least the wolves, particularly through the use of poison, which wolves are more vulnerable to than cougars and bears. And so they poisoned out and shot out and tracked out wolves. And they got used to this landscape without having to worry about predators, except maybe coyotes. And now, thankfully, due to the Endangered Species Act, we've reestablished and restored wolves across some parts of the West. And under some circumstances, the wolves will attack livestock. Now, I hasten to add, a lot of times the reason they attack livestock is self-created by the presence of livestock. What I mean by that is cattle, for some reason, are avoided by things like elk and deer and other prey species that wolves would normally prey upon. So if you move cattle in on an allotment, that where maybe elk were grazing, they hightail it out of the countryside or at least move to some distance. And particularly when wolves have pups, they're pretty limited in their ability to travel very far for, you know, hunting. And a lot of times, the more convenient or the most convenient food out there happens to be with four legs, this happens to be cattle. And so the wolves will attack the cattle in some cases, in those instances. And a lot of times they get pre-programmed to feed on cattle too. One of the ways is, again, because the cattle are out there and widely dispersed and not monitored greatly, if a cow dies, it just is left out on the landscape. And a lot of
so
times...
So it's easy, thickens, yeah.
Yeah, well, it becomes the gateway drug, so to speak. Wolves aren't, you know, they don't necessarily attack a live cow right away. They sort of learn about it. And one of the ways they learn about it is they find a dead cow and they feed on it. And then they say, okay, I can eat this. And then they smell a live cow and then they attack the live cow. So one of the things that's been shown is if you remove carcasses quickly, you have a lot less predation losses. The really troubling thing with wolves, and this has to do with other predators as well, cougars and bears and coyotes, is that if there's a livestock losses, on particularly on public lands, the standard procedure is to get rid of the predator. And at least my feeling is that the native species should be given priority on our public lands. In other words, if you're going to graze livestock on public lands, and this is private business trying to make a profit with public resources, you have to be willing to accept any losses from the native predators. But it gets even mm-hmm. more complex than that. And wolves aren't directly killed. So-called predator-friendly operations still have impacts on the wolves because, the cattle are still eating a lot of the forage that would otherwise sustain native prey species. So, for example, mm-hmm. Cattle eat grass and so do elk. And so if mm-hmm. you've got a lot of the forage out there being directed and consumed by domestic livestock, you have that much less for the native wildlife, which means you have that much less prey to support wolves and other predators. So, even if the a rancher doesn't necessarily shoot a predator, the presence of his livestock out there or her livestock is detrimental to the survival of those predators because they're taking literally food right out of their mouths. And then there's the social displacement too.
Yeah, I saw that you said that livestock grazing anywhere within a dozen miles is essentially on top of the pack. So
yes, it is, and the reason is because they they have to travel widely to find their food, and that's within the zone of travel for sure. And mm-hmm. and the other thing too with the livestock, and this is sort of it's harder to prove this, but nevertheless, I'm going to hypothesize it and say that it makes sense, which is if they don't attack the livestock, but the livestock socially displaces things like elk or deer or whatever else is their native prey, there's a lot of studies that will show that wolves won't necessarily attack livestock even if they're right out the front door, but they still have to travel further to get their prey. That exposes them to being hit on highways, being shot by hunters, being shot by a lot of states, like in Wyoming now, you can just shoot a wolf anytime you see them what they call a predator. So if they have to increase their travel in any way to get secure food, you're exposing them to more danger. So that's another way that livestock can have a negative impact on predators.
Well, an example of all this is the Profanity Peak Pack up in, there a Washington State University associate professor? I think his name was Robert Wilgus. I don't know if I'm saying his name correctly, but wasn't he kind of silenced?
Yes. In that particular situation, Dr. Watson, I say his name is Wilgus, but I don't know if I'm saying it correctly than you. But he was actually doing research on the Profanity Peak Pack and had cameras out there for motion-sensitive cameras and so forth. And what he documented was that the rancher turned out his cattle in that area near a denning site, and there were saw blocks which draw cattle in, placed very close to the den. And he had pictures on his camera showing that cattle were wandering very close to the den site. And then, not surprisingly, the wolves attacked some of the livestock, and then the pack was shot by the wildlife services. And the whole pack was eliminated eventually, but I might be incorrect on that. But anyway, a significant number of the wolves were killed. And Wilgus spoke out about this. He said, "Well, look, you're putting your cattle practically on top of. In fact, you are putting them right on top of the wolves, and you're just asking for trouble." And the university tried to silence him. They've tried to discredit his research. Now his funding has fallen down on the wayside because the ability to apply for grants he can't put his name on grant applications. I mean, they are persecuting him badly, and it's just mm-hmm. This is not the only example I could give, but I've seen it happen with other professors. This might be another topic to get into, but most of the research, most of the research in the West on livestock is done by range professors and range departments, and if you're a range professor, you know that your livelihood depends on having cattle on public lands. And you know that the students that are coming through your program are going to get jobs, and most of those jobs are going to be with public agencies. So you're sort of, whether implicitly recognized or explicitly recognized, your job is to somehow justify livestock production on public lands, which means that you try to search and do research that shows that grazing public lands is a net benefit to people. Or your research is how to minimize or reduce the impacts on things without actually eliminating livestock. And
to blame another species, like the wild horse is getting blamed for all the damage that the livestock is doing. And recently, I'm not sure how many people in our audience watched the BLM's National Wild Horse and Burro Advisory Board meeting, but there was one presentation given, and I could have driven holes through it with a Mack truck. And I'll probably end up writing an article about it. I think another advocate who's a science teacher, Bonnie Kohlreiter, and I wanted to just go over, review that plan because, you know, I'm not a scientist, but right away I could see a lot of problems with that report. So, anyhow.
Yeah, and this gets to another issue with that is what kinds of questions. I would say that I'm not trying to suggest that range professors, you know, lie about what they're finding or that they cook their data, but the kinds of questions you ask can determine the kinds of answers you get. And so they're very careful about the kinds of questions they ask and the kinds of answers they find. And oftentimes you'll find that their methodologies are suspect as well. I'll give you one example. I remember, this is quite a few years ago, but the BLM had these brochures around their offices about with the title, Livestock Grazing Benefits Riparian Areas. And they have maybe 8 or 10 examples from around the West where they suggested that livestock grazing was benefiting riparian areas. So I did a little background research on brochure. And what I found out was, for example, you might have a stream that was grazed for 4 months where they reduced the grazing to 2 months. And, of course, the riparian areas did better than when it was grazed by 4 months. So the argument was, well, the riparian area benefited with livestock grazing. Well, what they were documenting was a reduction in livestock grazing. So and so a reduction in the impacts. So it wasn't benefiting. Mm-hmm. So anyway,
that's a great example to know about, though. Yeah.
Yeah. And I've seen lots of studies like that related to range research.
Let's talk about sage grouse a little, because I know livestock grazing also impacts sage grouse. Can you tell our listeners about that? Tell them a little bit about sage grouse.
Now sage grouse is the largest of the grouse species. It's found in sagebrush habitat, as its name indicates, around the West. And its numbers have declined at least 50%, maybe some people as much as 75% since what they thought they were, you know, say 100 years ago. And the trend lines are not good. In other words, they're continuing to decline. And so they were proposed for listing under the Endangered Species Act. And that listing, as I mentioned earlier, was postponed while conservation measures were implemented. And, of course, a lot of the ranchers wanted to not see something listed, and so did the oil and gas industry, which also operates in sagebrush country. One of the factors that's an impact across its entire range has been livestock production. And livestock affects sage grouse at every stage of its life cycle. Anything else, whether it's oil and gas or housing tracts or whatever, either affects a small portion of the overall sage grouse habitat or only affects it at certain times of the year. Whereas sage grouse and livestock are affected in multiple ways. And I'll start off with the nesting hen. Sage grouse needs to hide from predators. And if you have a lot of grazing and there's less vegetation like grass out there, they can't hide as effectively from predators. So they're vulnerable. Also, the eggs, when the hen has to leave the feed, if there's not a lot of vegetation around, are more exposed to heat and cold. In other words, temperatures can hurt the egg's development. And then if the sage grouse chicks are successful and hatch out of their egg, the first about 4 to 6 weeks of their lives, they actually spend a lot of their time in riparian areas. Again, one of the species that finds riparian areas important. And they feed on insects and what are called forbs, which is flowers. And so if the riparian area is either shrunk because it's been trampled and eaten up by livestock, and or the vegetation has been removed so that the chicks are more exposed to predators, and or the cattle or sheep have eaten the flowers that the chicks prefer, there's all sorts of ways where the riparian area impacted by livestock negatively impacts the chicks. Okay, so they get through that 6 week period.
I was just saying, fences are a big problem too, right?
Right. I was just going to get to that. And then if they get through that 6 week period and they start to fly, they're poor flyers. Even adults are poor flyers, and it's a surprising amount. One study showed like almost 30% mortality of sage grouse adults die from collisions with fences. Well, why do we have fences out there? I mean, most of the sagebrush habitat never had anything like fences, obviously. So the sage grouse have collisions with fences and die. And so that's an impact. Another impact is that, as I previously mentioned, is wildfires that burn up the sagebrush habitat, which is facilitated by cheatgrass, which is facilitated by livestock. Another impact is there's a West Nile virus in some sagebrush habitat affects the birds and will kill them as well. And they get that from mosquitoes. And in a lot of this arid landscape that the sagebrush is found in, you know, water is pretty scarce. And so one of the ways that livestock production affects them is they put out artificial stock ponds or they put out watering troughs, et cetera. And those become great breeding habitat for the mosquitoes that carry the West Nile virus. So as you have more livestock production, you have more of that West Nile virus being spread by mosquitoes. And then
go ahead.
And then beyond that, you have the fact that the birds that recognize the fences are a place where avian predators like golden eagles and ravens will perch on the fence posts. So they tend to avoid those fences for sometimes up to a mile on either side. So a lot of good habitat gets eliminated. And then I mentioned the hayfields. The hayfields that a lot of the native vegetation in valley bottoms have been converted to hayfields, that monoculture, particularly after the hay is cut, provides no hiding cover for sage grouse, and they become reluctant to, again, because they're poor flyers and vulnerable, they become reluctant to fly across hayfields. So and a lot of times that will fragment sage grouse habitat by the presence of large hayfields, which will then separate populations. And then
We've got a caller calling with a question, but go ahead and finish your thought. So go ahead and finish your thought. And then
the final, you know, there are many other ways that sage grouse are affected, but another way is that in a lot of places, the government actually is trying to get rid of sage grouse through herbicides and so forth because they prefer to have grass there for cattle. So, you know, they're eliminating the food that
they're calling it sagebrush control programs when actually they're just getting rid of it. Yeah. And spraying bad chemicals on our public lands. Marty, did someone call in with a question?
Yes, area code 303. You're live and on the air with Debbie.
Hi, do you have a question?
Hi, yeah, I have a question. That's quite a litany of factors that impact the sage grouse from livestock. And I just wonder, this is Charlotte from Berthoud, Colorado, and I just wonder, Has Fish and Wildlife or has any government agency besides the GAO potentially ever addressed those issues? Because it seems to me all they do is just talk about the wild horses. The wild horses, you know, are hurting the sage grouse. And except for independent voices, we never see any acknowledgement of those factors. So maybe I'm missing something, am I?
No, you're not. You have hit on the ranching culture has a huge impact on even how the BLM and so forth conducts its research and what the Fish and Wildlife Service is willing to admit. They do not want to point a finger at the livestock industry. And so they ignore these impacts. And I can give, you know, I don't know if I'm allowed to say this publicly, but I have a good friend who worked for the BLM, was an expert on sagebrush, and was on the original sage-grouse scientific identification team that was looking at factors affecting sage-grouse. And he was taken off because he consistently was saying livestock was having a negative impact. So he was removed from the team. So you have that kind of background shenanigans going on that, therefore, the people that are left on the sage-grouse team know what the message is, even if they were going to mention anything about livestock impacts, they know that they'll, you know, get removed from the team, so they keep silent.
It's their job, yeah. Yeah. Thanks for calling in, Charlotte. George, what are some solutions? Allotment buyouts?
Again, I want to repeat that grazing on public lands is a privilege. The amount of people that graze on public land and utilize public land forage for their livestock production is a tiny fraction of the livestock industry in the whole country. And the economic impact of public lands forage is very insignificant. Not long ago, I was doing some research on public lands grazing in Idaho, for example, and the research I turned up suggested that if you eliminated all grazing on public lands in Idaho, just to use an example, you would replace those jobs and that income within 30 days of the Idaho economy's growth. So we're not talking about a very important part of the Western economy. And also, there are other studies that show that ranching in the West, for the most part, depends on the economy of the larger communities. In other words, with the exception of very wealthy ranchers, a lot of people derive a lot more of their income from being a bus driver for the school system or whatever, you know, working on the road crew, et cetera, and that the ranching is something they do because they like to do it, but they don't really make a lot of money out of it. And then... Mm-hmm. The vast majority, and this is all background context, but the vast majority of AUMs, which is how they measure forage on public lands, animal unit much, how much it takes to support a cow and calf for a month, a vast majority of AUMs are controlled by a very small number of property owners because a lot of the allotment is based on how much private land you control. If you control a lot of private land, you tend to control a lot of public land. So the wealthier you are, the more likely you are to have a lot of public lands AUM. So ironically, some of the biggest grazers on public land are corporations, whether either very wealthy individuals or mining companies or other corporations, not, you know, your small-town rancher. So all that said, we really don't have to allow any grazing, but because of the politics, it's very difficult to eliminate grazing on public lands. And the best method that has arisen so far is to what they call allotment permit buyout programs. And how they work is you find a rancher who is willing to give up their grazing privileges in exchange for some sort of monetary compensation. Now, again, this is like paying a renter that's in your house and is destroying your house and you want to get rid of them. You know, it might be just easier to pay them to leave. Well, that's kind of the same idea. So you say, if you will eliminate your livestock from the public land, we'll give you X amount of dollars. And then the agency, whether it's the Forest Service or the BLM or in some cases, it might be on Park Service land, wherever the grazing is occurring, they agree to remove their cattle, and the agency will permanently close that allotment so that no future grazing occurs.
George, we only have about 30 seconds left on our show, so I'm going to have you on again because this has been just wonderful, really informative, and you're a great guest, so I'm going to have you back on again, but I got to wrap up because we only have a few seconds, but thank you so much for being on the show tonight. And thanks for all the work you're doing. I'd like to remind everybody, call your U.S. senators and ask them not to kill euthanize or sterilize our wild horses and burros, and we do not want horse slaughterhouses in the United States. Thanks, everyone, for listening, and bye, George. Thank you. Thanks, everyone. Good night.
Okay. Good night.